From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Citizen-led, nonviolent movements have brought down dictators, ended hostile occupations, even toppled communism. Tonight, On Point, legendary activist Gene Sharp talks about the place and effectiveness of nonviolence in today's guns and tanks world. We begin with the latest on the Iraq crisis. Weapons inspectors are set to begin their work tomorrow. As they do, U.S. and British military forces are already in gear and engaged. Major Charles Heyman is editor of Jane's World Armies. I asked him to describe the level of military activity in and around Iraq in advance of possible all-out conflict.
The campaign itself has already started, and the campaign started in late October with an intensification of airstrikes outside of the no-fly zones. And we've seen quite a lot of airstrikes now during the last 6 weeks or so. Now we're into a new phase of the campaign now. The airstrikes go on, but what we're seeing now is force protection around the Kuwait area, making sure that the assets that the coalition have got on the ground there are well protected in case of any preemptive strike by Saddam Hussein.
When you say force protection, you mean from the air?
I mean air, ground, sea. There are considerable naval assets there, and there are considerable air assets as well. And, of course, we've got quite a lot of troops now in Kuwait, and that needs to be protected before the main part of the campaign actually starts. And in the meantime, we've got quite a lot of psychology going here, convincing Saddam Hussein that resistance is futile, that he must surrender to the inspectors all of the weapons of mass destruction assets that he might have.
What about the simple arithmetic here, buildup of troops, of materiel? Is it possible to track? Do you have a sense of where that stands?
We're pretty sure that there are enough troops there, enough assets on the ground, air, land and sea, to ensure force protection, to make sure that Saddam Hussein can't do any sort of preemptive strike. But we're also pretty sure that there are nowhere near enough troops there at the moment to start a proper campaign. Now, by around about mid-December, there may be enough troops there to start some sort of out-of-the-box operations to put pressure on Saddam Hussein, maybe using the Kurds in the north and the Shiites in the south and the east. But they'll need considerably more troops to start the big campaign that everybody's expecting that might be some sort of invasion of Iraq.
We've been hearing whispers about infiltration already underway, the possibility of U.S. special forces already being in the no-fly zone areas, perhaps among the Kurds. Is there evidence of that?
Interesting you should say that, because, again, when the history of this campaign is written, we will be almost certainly saying that we had evidence that there were special forces certainly in Kurdistan and in the south from April, May of 2002. So, in fact, they've been there for quite a long time.
And what would they be doing?
Well, basically, they're organizing the people on the ground so that if they need to use them, they'll be much, much better trained and much, much better coordinated with the overall coalition effort than we saw with the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan. That had to be put together literally at a moment's notice. This time round, the use of proxies, if they're going to use them, will be much better coordinated, much better organized.
But these no-fly zones only prohibit Iraqi air. They don't prohibit Iraqi officials on the ground. So doesn't that mean that our special forces would already be potentially in proximity to Iraqi officials or troops?
By and large, of course, where the special forces are, they're in areas that really aren't under Saddam Hussein's control. I mean, nominally on the map, they're part of Iraq. But on the reality on the ground is that Saddam Hussein's officials and his forces are well out of the way, and they're not in large numbers in those areas, and they try and keep out of them.
Is there evidence that we are arming potential Kurdish opposition, potential Iraqi dissident opposition in these areas?
Well, I've seen some fantastic video film in the last month of Kurdish troops in training, and it's quite obvious they're being trained by coalition instructors. They're very smart, very well motivated, well equipped, and although I didn't see anything of any evidence at all of coalition instructors on the videos, I mean, it's quite obvious that these Kurds had not been training themselves.
Is there any estimate of how many U.S. troops, special forces, might already be in Iraq today?
No, we haven't got those figures at the moment, and it would be wrong to talk about the actual numbers because we never know what might happen. We don't want to help Saddam Hussein's intelligence people out.
And the bombing, you described it as having gone outside of the no-fly zones in response to clashes there or Iraqi air defenses being lit up there. How far outside no-fly zones has the bombing gone?
Well, we've seen a couple of attacks quite a long way away outside of the no-fly zones. Most of these attacks are directed against air defense command and control centers. So this is classic preparation of the terrain, basically, making sure that when they decide to do something really big, that the air defenses have been taken out and the air defenses have been neutralized. But mainly attacks against air defense centers, although we have seen an attack against some surface-to-surface anti-ship missiles stationed in the Basra area, which also, you know, leads us to start to believe that maybe coalition forces are going to use Basra as a target, take Basra and use Basra as a very, very good logistics base, take the airfields there. And also that would increase the pressure on Saddam Hussein tremendously.
If you could chart the likely progress of activity here, are we likely to see a continuing gradual ramp of greater and greater military activity, more and more attacks, or is it low level and then a spike when the campaign formally begins?
It's really difficult to call at the moment, but I think that both George Bush and Tony Blair are in this one for maybe the longer game than most people thought, and that they're going to allow the inspections to take their course, and they're probably going to allow Saddam Hussein and his cronies to hang themselves along the way. And there is always the hope on both sides of the Atlantic that the large-scale attack that everyone is expecting won't be necessary, and that Saddam Hussein will either roll over and declare everything and let the inspectors take everything away, mm-hmm. or that he might himself get up, get into his private jet, and leave Iraq. And that I would say there is probably a 30 to 40% chance of that happening.
Charles Heyman, how far could we push this war before the war without it actually becoming the war? How far can you go without actually being at war?
Well, that's very, very difficult, and you'd have to talk to some great legal minds to get an answer to that one. The best way I can describe it is there is a campaign going on, and that campaign probably started around about mid to late October. And when people write the history of this whole thing, I think that's the start date that they will use.
Charles Heyman, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Major Charles Heyman is editor of Jane's World Armies. He spoke with us earlier from Shrewsbury, England. Whatever you do, don't call him a peacenik. Longtime proponent of nonviolent action, Gene Sharp says that makes it sound like he's avoiding conflict. No way, he says. Conflict is real. It's important. It shows something's wrong. Nonviolence isn't about avoiding conflict. It's about resolving conflict, defining it, engaging it, and working through it even when that's hard. You don't need guns and tanks to affect change, Sharp says. Change can come through small steps, steps any one of us can take any day. In fact, he says, some of the most successful political upheavals from India to Poland to Serbia have come through nonviolent citizen movements. Can you hear it now? In an age of weapons of mass destruction and terrorism, do we have the patience, do we have the time for nonviolent conflict resolution? Is it time for war or to step back, for guns or Gandhi? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Gene Sharp. He's founder and president of the Albert Einstein Institution, a nonprofit organization that promotes nonviolent struggle. Good evening and welcome, Gene Sharp.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for being with us. Gene Sharp, you're the man of the hour. You've got a full page in the New York Times Sunday Magazine. People are asking about the nonviolent conflict resolution that you've espoused for a long time. You've been a big wheel in that movement. But at this moment where we're looking at the possibility of an imminent war, is it relevant?
I would clarify your terminology a little
please
bit,
do.
If
please
I
do.
May.
Hone us in.
Because I'm not focusing on conflict resolution, which usually implies that you have some kind of a compromise and agreement and mm-hmm. everything's fine and rosy. Mm-hmm. I'm talking really something more like nonviolent struggle, mm-hmm. nonviolent war. In fact, one of the books from the 1930s was called War Without Violence. So it's not how to make peace with a dictatorship. It's how to undermine the dictatorship and disintegrate it.
So it's not about compromise.
No.
It's about a struggle as serious, as deep-seated as the struggles we imagine in war, but without the violence.
Yes. And we know that that's realism because it has happened in a whole series of historical cases, including struggles against the Nazis, struggles in Eastern Europe, Poland, the liberation of the three little Baltic countries.
Latvia, Estonia.
Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania. Mm-hmm. And Serbia, where our work had a significant influence also.
We're going to look at those, but we have to do all of that, of course, tonight in the context of the potentially imminent hot war that everyone's looking at, and that is Iraq. When you look at what's going on right now, Gene Sharp, with the United Nations, with the weapons inspections regime that's been required by the Security Council, here we have a situation where Saddam is being told, lay down your arms or prove that you don't have them, and there will be no war. At the same time, we have all the machinery of war gathering at his borders. Does this qualify, by your definition, as a nonviolent struggle to date so far?
No. No, but what did qualify was the women's demonstration in Baghdad on the 22nd of October.
This is after Saddam declared an amnesty for thousands of prisoners. They came out. Some sisters, mothers, wives couldn't find their husbands.
Right.
And they were mad, and they were in the streets challenging Saddam Hussein.
That's correct. That proves that all these sayings that it's impossible to use nonviolent struggle in Iraq are false, because they were doing this in face of great danger, and they were had the guts to get out there and protest and demand, where are our husbands, where are our sons? And this has happened in other countries where supposedly nonviolent struggle was impossible, but it happened. Milosevic was a terrible dictatorship. U.S. and NATO did all kinds of bombing in Serbia. Mm-hmm. He remained in power. Mm-hmm. But then the people organized studying nonviolent struggle, and the Otpor, predominantly youth movement, mm-hmm. practice there. One of my publications that was cited in the Times Magazine article, From Dictatorship to Democracy,
was circulated among dissidents there?
In Serbia.
Mm-hmm.
And they undermined the legitimacy of Milosevic. They withdrew the support and obedience. They came in later on in hundreds of thousands of people to Belgrade, having organized over the whole country. And Milosevic's power was dissolved.
Of course, then, as now, there was a very large military backdrop to that activity, though. I mean, George Bush would clearly, and Tony Blair, as our guest Charles Heyman said just earlier in our debrief, George Bush and Tony Blair would be delighted if Iraqis would stand up now and overthrow Saddam Hussein. It might make war unnecessary. But is it not the threat of war? All those fighter jets and aircraft carriers and troops and special forces and proven willingness to use them and smart bombs and predators and drones and all the rest that have created the situation that has raised the temperature under Saddam Hussein, that may be giving hope to Iraqis that it's worth standing up. Would anything happen without that external military threat?
I think, of course. Of course it could.
He's been the leader for 20 years now, and it hasn't happened.
But look in Poland, when you had a Nazi occupation, you had a communist regime, you had Soviet occupation, you had the KGB there, and the workers organized solidarity unions, and in 10 years dissolved the communist system completely, and there was no U.S. or NATO military threat whatsoever.
Well, there was NATO. I mean, there was a standoff, at least. There was a military opposition,
which they had been in mm-hmm. place for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And this group of simple people decided, we're not going to put up with this anymore. We're going to organize. We're going to refuse to work under these particular conditions. And they published illegal publications and resistance literature and on down the line. And that was what brought down the communist regime in Poland.
We don't have time to answer this before the break, but I'll put the question out there for you. We'll come back to it. I wonder if that means you would say we should then pull the fighter jets away from Iraq, pull the troops back, pull the aircraft carriers away, and wait for the Iraqi people to topple this leader. Hold the thought, because we've got to take a short break, but we'll come right back to it. We're talking tonight with Gene Sharp, legendary nonviolent struggle activist, thinker, writer. We're talking about conflict without guns, about peace without illusions. Is it too late for nonviolence in Iraq? And which gets to the heart of a conflict more effectively, nonviolence or war? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about conflict without guns, about peace without illusions. My guest is Gene Sharp. He's president and founder of the Albert Einstein Institution in Boston. He's author of a number of books on nonviolent struggle, power, political problems, dictatorships, defense policy, including the seminal The Politics of Nonviolent Action, and more recently, From Dictatorship to Democracy. You can join the conversation as well. Do we have the patience and the time to go the nonviolent path today? Does America's war-making power make nonviolent efforts look like too much trouble, too slow, too weak? And does war create resolution or just victory and loss? Does nonviolence create resolution? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join Gene Sharp. So here it is, Gene Sharp, the Iraq situation.
You don't deal with a dictator by simply refusing to use your military means and waiting.
All right.
To my knowledge, none of the superpowers, meaning the United States, England, et cetera, are devoting any effort whatsoever to developing the kind of struggle which brought liberation to Eastern Europe.
What would that look like if they were, if they had been? How would it begin? How would it proceed, ideally?
The research you're talking about?
If instead of the kind of superpower military instinctive response to Iraq that we've demonstrated,
yes,
if the United States government had stepped back and said, you know what, let's put the Pentagon to the side and use Gene Sharp's formula, what might that have looked like? How might the problem of a dictator armed with weapons of mass destruction, sitting on top of an important global resource, how might that have been addressed through nonviolent means? What might the United States have encouraged? What might still happen inside Iraq on that path?
You'd have to spread the knowledge and the know-how of how to resist, how to refuse to cooperate, how to slow down the system, how to call strikes, how to have protest demonstrations to people through literature, through radio, through financial support for nonviolent struggle movements inside Iraq, comparable to what was done in Serbia, where it was reported the United States directly and indirectly put in about $25 million to support the nonviolent struggle movements to vote for. Mm-hmm. To my knowledge, they're putting in nothing toward developing nonviolent struggle movements in Iraq, which the kind of struggle which often works quite quickly.
Well, they're dropping leaflets advising Iraqi soldiers not to fight if they're attacked.
Well, that's fine, but that's insufficient. You have to have a plan. You can't sort of pull out some blueprint and apply it in any particular country you want to, like Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just superimpose on Iraq what was done in Serbia or what was done in Lithuania or what was done in Poland.
But we are told that the Saddam's Ba'athist regime is so brutal, so violent, so willing to slaughter a dissident's entire family at the drop of a hat, that a resistance movement along the lines we saw with the Solidarity movement in Poland or perhaps the anti-Milosevic movement in Serbia, that simply can't grow here, that Saddam's proven that he knows how to muscle this country to the floor.
Sure. He inspires terror. He makes people afraid, which makes people fear of that regime and that punishment, and therefore they don't try. But we know that in regimes that have been equally brutal, under Nazi occupations, for example, that this kind of struggle has been used, even improvised, by people who really didn't know too much about what they were doing, and sometimes they won.
Where did that happen under Nazism? Most of us think of a military triumph over Nazism.
There was a military triumph over Nazism. It was used by the resistance movement in occupied Norway, for example.
Mm-hmm.
The teachers are simply one part of the Norwegian population that did this against the Quisling regime. It was used by women in Berlin in 1943 whose Jewish husbands had been seized, and they got out in the streets and demanded that their Jewish husbands be released. Mm-hmm. And that was within a block or so of Gestapo headquarters. Mm-hmm. There's a very important book on that by Nathan Stoltzfus called Resistance of the Heart. And some of those Jewish men, as a result of the demonstration of the women, survived the war, lived after it. And this type of struggle is used in many parts of the world. Sometimes the stereotype is it takes forever, and that's nonsense. Wars sometimes take a very, very long time.
Mm-hmm. But sometimes, some people are saying this war began 10 years ago, and it's still being continued.
But sometimes nonviolent struggle can work quite quickly. But it's not a panacea. You have to study how it works. It's more complicated than military struggle. You have to have your detailed planning and analysis of what you might do, see what the balance of forces is, where are the weaknesses of the regime.
Is it worth it if during all that time the regime is, we're told, developing weapons of mass destruction, if during all that time millions of Iraqis are living under oppression, is it possible, particularly now where we don't think of trench warfare and endless slaughter, is it possible that war might, on balance, be more effective because it's quicker, it lances the boil, it gets a change of regime, and you don't have 10 more years of suffering waiting for it to happen?
Well, you'll have various years of suffering if it does happen. But this is not a panacea. You can't come up to the edge of the cliff and say, okay, you solved the problem for us. Mm-hmm. You have to start ahead of time. And there are cases where it's too late to really be successful because there were no preparations made, no planning, no analysis, no communication in the languages of the people as to this type of struggle.
Are you suggesting it's a lost cause then in Iraq for the nonviolent path?
The demonstration of the women on October 22nd mm-hmm. demonstrates it's not. And you do get cases where people have spontaneously, without this preparation, decide that this is enough, and now we're going to resist and defy at great risk. And they know that the struggle will not be easy, but sometimes people are pushed to the point they're willing to take a risk, just like they do in violent rebellions, mm-hmm. just like they do in wars, except that this is conducted by means which are more, I would argue, are more difficult for the regime to deal with.
Listeners, Gene Sharp is a proponent, a legendary proponent, of nonviolent struggle, nonviolent war. What do you think? If we put Gandhi and Saddam in the ring, who wins? Who wins today? Is there time for a nonviolent approach to Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Scott is on the line. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I actually went to a Quaker school for 12 years, so I believe strongly in nonviolence as a means to handling certain situations. But my comment is really this. In the examples that were cited earlier, mm-hmm. many of the problems were regimes that were repressing sort of internal societies, and there was obviously reason to try and change the situation there. But the whole premise for the current situation with the United States and our allies against Iraq mm-hmm. Is based upon a, sort of an imminent danger because of weapons of mass destruction against the United States and other countries, as opposed to changing a situation from within.
So it's not purely an internal Iraqi affair?
Yes, correct. And that while the demonstrations by the women of Iraq several weeks ago may go along, you know, as an important step towards changing the situation of the Iraqis themselves, the whole premise for our military aggression at this time or stance is because we believe that we face imminent danger from the regime in Iraq.
And so Scott, you're the guy with 12 years of Quaker schooling. Are you saying that in spite of that, in your belief in nonviolence, you see the need for a military response this time?
I guess my comment is that if we really truly believe that there is imminent danger from the regime that exists, do we have time, number one, to have that play itself out?
Yep.
And number two, is going to be enough to change the regime if that's what has existed for 20 years?
Scott, thanks for your call. Let me put it to Gene Sharp. Gene, I guess two issues I hear. One is transnational conflict. If the problem is bigger than a nation's own internal problem, if it involves and maybe even threatens populations of other countries, then in this case, can we still wait on the Iraqi people to solve this if Americans and others outside of Iraq are threatened? And second, the time issue. Once weapons of mass destruction are put into the equation and the threat is described and is sometimes described as imminent, we've been told that Saddam, you know, true or false, but that we've been told, it's been suggested he could have a nuclear weapon within a matter of months or a couple of years. Can we still wait on nonviolent action to address situations like that?
Well, you've had cases of international threat before, mm-hmm. with the Nazi regime, for example, invading and occupying much of Western Europe. In this kind of case, if there are weapons of mass destruction, bacteriological, chemical...
Even nuclear.
Nuclear. The sure way to get them used is to start a military war. That's a way almost guarantees that if they're there, they would be used.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that seems to me a very foolish way of avoiding the problem of weapons of mass destruction. Much more effective is to figure out how on earth can you undermine this regime from inside. How can you determine where are the weaknesses of the regime? How can the people living under that regime who have suffered terribly, not just the people living in the middle of Iraq, mm-hmm. but the Kurds, the gassing of those people.
The Shiites, everybody.
And mm-hmm. in the swamp Arabs, mm-hmm. and their habitat destroyed, mm-hmm. and so on. To try to oppose that regime by the very means by which that regime is strongest.
What kind of weaknesses then would you look for from your experience? I don't know how familiar you are with Iraq in particular, but where would your experience lead you to look as places to say, here's where the Iraqi people ought to push, here's where Saddam might be weak?
You already have certain ethnic and religious differences within Iraq. I'm no expert on Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
But you obviously have.
We all know we have the Kurds, we have the Sunni
yes.
Muslims, we have the Shiite Muslims.
Yeah, and dissidents inside the central part of mm-hmm. Iraq. Also, the regime like that attempts to control more than it's capable of controlling efficiently. People hurt, like, from that regime and its mm-hmm. repression. Like those women, where's my son? Where's my husband? You know, and they got out there and were demanding. Now, sometimes that's just a one-shot demonstration and doesn't lead to anything. Sometimes that begins to escalate and they begin to see, yes, we can protest. Yes, we can resistance. And if the transportation begins to slow down or the trains stop, the highways are blocked, if the civil servants are fed up with administering that kind of policy, if some of the conscript soldiers really don't want to serve that kind of a dictator, they can slow down and be inefficient in the repression. All parts of the society begin to slow down. It's like sawing off the legs of a table. Take away the supports. Take away the institutions that give power.
And yet all this, I hear it, and I know it. I spent a year in India studying Gandhi's movement in Southeast India. But the picture that's painted of urgency in regard to Iraq creates a kind of immediate disconnect when I hear these things described. First of all, why haven't they happened over the last 20 years? And secondly, if the threat is as urgent as we're told, can we wait for this kind of movement to mount gradually from the grassroots and maybe someday that little knot of mothers in Baghdad turns into a mob, a mass that pushes out Saddam? But how long? How many years?
The regime in Serbia was very brutal. We were over there in May after the October uprising,
mm-hmm.
and people would say, and also someone came to our office, that we were out on the street, we were always afraid, we were always looking around. Mm-hmm. And then he's gone, we can just walk. You see, that happened quickly. There was a retired U.S. Army colonel did a workshop in Budapest at the time Milosevic was very strong on this kind of struggle, to identify the sources of power and figure out how to take them away. And that group became the leadership of this movement called Otpor, or Resistance, mm-hmm. which was the main group undermining the Milosevic regime.
So even in the cauldron of events, you say it can happen quickly. Let's turn to the phones. George is on the line. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The question that I had was, and I'm going with Serbia versus Iraq to begin with, would the military buildup against Serbia in the war act as the catalyst for the internal nonviolent? My feeling was, from listening to what was being said, that had we not gone in and fought a war in Serbia, would his internal government or the internal people not have pushed him out and said, we've had enough of this?
Right.
That was my primary question. The secondary one would just simply be, with Iraq, as you said, the urgency. Saddam has shown that he's willing to use weapons of mass destruction, biological, chemical, against his own people, against the Kurds. And I'll take my questions off here.
Okay, George, thanks for calling. Well, here we come to this again. George is listening. You're describing what happened in Serbia, and he calls and asks, is it not possible that the military pressure created by NATO's advance by the bombing served as a catalyst for the very internal nonviolent movement that you describe?
I found no evidence of that whatsoever. When we were there in May, we asked quite a few questions. What was the effect of the bombing and the destruction of the bridges and so forth and so on? And everybody, without exception, told us that stopped the internal resistance from going ahead. It was not a catalyst. It was not a help for the internal resistance. It really got rid of Milosevic.
Then why hadn't the internal resistance developed years earlier? Would have saved everybody a lot of pain and suffering.
Sure would have. What resources were put into helping that? You know, but they put millions and billions of dollars in building up military capacity and military planning, and to my knowledge, not $1 to developing this other possibility, which is this kind of struggle that's responsible for, to a large degree, for the liberation of most of Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't say, well, could this be relevant anywhere else if we learned how to refine it and develop it?
If it's so good, if it's so relatively cheap, why don't we do it? Why don't we encourage it? Why don't we systematically propagate this kind of resistance to dictatorship?
That's my point.
But what's the answer?
People don't get it. They have a kind of naive faith that the real power is violence and war. Even when violence and war have often failed and produced disastrous results, have gone on for years and years and not worked quickly, and produced a terrible regime afterwards. But the nonviolent struggle, which has done all these things and many more, is neglected in the groups, the very few groups that are trying to deal with this hard-headed type, not the mushy-mushy nonviolence, but hard-headed, tough nonviolent struggle, gets very, very little support.
It sounds like maybe George Bush and Tony Blair could use some of this strategy in the next several months. It might help them.
But they can't do it. It has to be done by the people in the country, but the people outside could help on developing the analyses, developing the strategic estimates of strengths and weaknesses, of developing communications, of paying for printing costs and smuggling literature, of radio programs beamed into the country about this kind of resistance, and the reports of what is already going on in terms of resistance in those countries.
Gene Sharp, I just wonder if you might not, at least in that narrow respect, be talking a special forces line right now. We're hearing that they might like to avoid this war. If there's a way to do it, we'll come back and get your response to that. We're talking this hour about conflict without guns, about peace without illusions. If we put Gandhi and Saddam in the ring, who wins? Does nonviolence work in the face of weapons of mass destruction and terrorism? Is it naive? Or is it the only long-term path to resolution, to peace? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about conflict without guns, about peace without illusions. My guest is Gene Sharp. He's president and founder of the Albert Einstein Institution in Boston. He's author of The Politics of Nonviolent Action, of From Dictatorship to Democracy, professor emeritus of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. He has traveled the world and covered the world in his writing about nonviolent struggle. Not something passive, not lying back, but actively, deliberately, strategically using nonviolent efforts to topple dictators. What about this time? What about Saddam? Is it too late for nonviolence in Iraq? And which gets to the heart of a conflict more effectively, nonviolence or war? Do you want George W. Bush to listen to Gene Sharp? Or not. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Imran's on the line. Hi, Imran. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Fine.
I just want to say that I agree 100% with Mr. Sharp and his views, but I'd like to address two points. One is that why don't we take this road of nonviolence that has high impact. I think that, to take a cynical view, I don't think the administration looks at it as being in its interest, because
Why not, Imran?
Well, like I say, nothing boosts the polls like a war. I mean, it helps the economy. It helps bring a sense of, sloganeering, rah-rah, let's go.
So you've got the wag-the-dog cynicism. And the other reason?
And then I just wanted to raise the issue about the issue of urgency. And, I think that the fellow who was a Quaker said that, we had to go in there because of he's demonstrated that he's used gas once. He'll do it again. And I think my thought is that, it's one thing to gas your own people who are civilians and they don't have any weapons, and it's quite another to basically go and use it against another country that has the means to basically, wallop you right back. And so I don't think Saddam would be willing to use his weapons of mass destruction unless he was backed into a corner. I think the CIA's basically came to the same conclusion on that fact as well.
But Imran, do you think if the United States leaned back now, brought the troops home, stood down, took the pressure away, took the knife away from the throat, that the Iraqi people would stand up and take care of this?
Well, I think, it probably has some, creates leverage to kind of have the warplanes and everything there. And maybe that's a positive sign. But I also think that we haven't historically given diplomacy a chance when it's come to Iraq. And I hearken back to the 91 first war when people urged the Bush administration towards diplomacy, and they never took it. I mean, I think they repainted a scenario of either you do it this or you're going to get, going to get a fist down your throat. And never left the avenue for diplomacy there. And I don't think we would do that now, and I feel like to take the knife away, so to speak, it's not really in our nature to do it, but I think we want to see a result by the next quarter.
Imran, thanks for your call. Gene Sharp, are you equally cynical about U.S. motives in Iraq, about the willingness to use war for political manipulation at home? Can you imagine this administration taking a different path?
I don't know what all their motives are. The point is not what are their motives, but what are the options. And it's not a case of withdrawing and canceling out the military, and then you have nonviolent struggles. We have sort of coming along. No.
Okay.
No. Nonviolent struggle needs to, if it can happen spontaneously, it can be powerful, it can be organized by people in the crisis themselves, but also it's stronger and more effective if it's studied and planned, if war games are developed to how to apply this.
Nonviolent war games.
Nonviolent war games are prepared to how to wage this kind of struggle. And if we're too late with the nonviolent option in Iraq, which is possible, they may just go ahead. Once you're near a cliff and you're charging ahead and you got no brakes on the car,
momentum comes into play.
Then you're going to go over the cliff.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that's wise or stupid or whatever is irrelevant. But if you can prepare this kind of struggle for the next major conflict, what about the dictatorship in Zimbabwe, for example, where opposition people are studying nonviolent struggle as a way of dealing with that regime instead of guerrilla warfare? What about the other places in the world that either have now dictators or are likely to get them in the next few years?
How do you do it? Do you deploy the CIA to spread literature and have training camps in the jungle about how to overthrow? And then are you accused of CIA interventionism?
No, I'm not talking about the CIA at all. I have no connections there.
Ranks of Quakers marching forth?
No, certainly not. That's a very different thing.
How would the U.S. help encourage? Let's take a less urgent scenario than Zimbabwe, though it's pretty urgent itself.
Yes. You have to have a focus of research and analysis on the nature of this kind of struggle, using historical knowledge to where we can get it, where this kind of struggle has happened, but it's happened in many, many places in the 20th century.
But you're talking a third-party research of a specific political situation.
It can be.
And then how is that insight, that learning infused, how is it injected into that political reality?
People there often want it. They often come to us, even though we're a tiny group with very little publicity and very little connections. We had communications these past 2 weeks directly from Iran, from people there who were conducting struggle against the repressive religious regime.
A quite active struggle among Tehran students right now.
Yes, and there's stories in the New York Times mm-hmm. today indicate they're trying to keep it nonviolent, keep it peaceful, but militant. And the people there are asking for it. People from other situations in other countries had come to us. It's like the people from Serbia found this, the awareness of this kind of struggle, and then they learned about it, read about it, and then they ran with it and did it.
So have a playbook, make it aggressive, make it nonviolent. Scott's calling from Wabasha, Minnesota. Hi, Scott. You're on the air. Or Skip, I'm sorry. Hello, Skip.
Yeah, good evening.
Hi.
I guess there's a couple of things that I want to point out. One, I don't hear a lot of concrete answers, and I think you've kind of alluded to the same thing. You keep looking for a plan, an alternative plan to what we're doing right now, and I really haven't heard a coherent, a point-for-point plan. And, even if it's a theoretical one, it'd be nice to hear it, if we could set up a theoretical situation.
Right. We'll give Gene Sharp a chance to do that. Is something else on your mind, Skip?
Well, and number two is I don't think you can draw a parallel between Serbia and Iraq directly. Yes, religion is part of the picture, but Iraq has some neighbors that are extremely nervous about the situation, not only, in fact, nervous about us getting involved in it. I think everybody was kind of hands-off as far as Serbia is concerned. We didn't have the threat of a bunch of other neighbors getting involved in this situation.
So you think the stakes are higher here. Let me take those, Skip, and thanks for your call, Gene Sharp. Here's the call for detail, detail, detail. Make it real. Make it more real. I've heard you describing it, but can it be even more concrete?
You don't make it detailed on the spur of the moment on mm-hmm. a talk show. This requires weeks and months of detailed study by people who really know the society, know the situation, know dictatorships, and know nonviolent struggle.
We won't ask you to do detail that is specific for Iraq necessarily, but can you make it just more granular in a sense of how this kind of program might be unfolded? We won't ask you to take it to Baghdad and stand by it. But you hear the request is help us visualize it more concretely. We can visualize the war pretty concretely at this point. We've been told here's the drone, here's the fighter jet, here's the aircraft carrier, here's how it will work, here's the tanks.
To understand that, you have to see where it has been applied in other countries in very difficult situations in which they organized secretly many times, in which they initiated protests, in which they had underground illegal publications, illegal radio stations. They slowed down and paralyzed the transportation system, paralyzed at times the industrial system, rejected the political regime they would no longer obey, and even began to undermine the military forces. This you take what are the sources of power of the regime. How can you weaken those? How can you take those away?
Are there... I guess this has happened on many continents, but are there cultural requirements for this? Have you seen this happen in the Middle East? Do you have any reason to think that this might be a culture that doesn't support that kind of resistance? Or is this a human capacity that's absolutely global, that's universal?
Margaret Mead, the famous anthropologist, when she reviewed the politics of nonviolence, said that this was a not culturally specific. We know that nonviolent struggle has been used by Muslims and by Arabs, used by Egyptians against British rule, used in the Sudan in 63 or 64, similar types of resistance in Sudan in 85, other kinds of resistance even in Iraq itself. This is not something that Arabs can't do. This is not something that Muslims won't do. This is applied regardless of religion, regardless of the particular culture in which people happen to live.
Kevin's on the line. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I would, to use your vernacular, put Gandhi in the hands of the two most powerful groups, the U.S. public and the Iraqi public.
What do you mean exactly, Kevin?
Well, for a concrete plan, I'll just throw this out there. I think you need a nonviolent protest symbol. You need a sticker or a flag or something that we can all use, that Kevin Dennis in Boston can use, the farmer in Kansas can use, the farmer, the merchant in Iraq can use, and it would just be a very simple sticker. It would say NW or no war or something.
So you want a big peace sign to be floated?
Yes. I'm serious, because despite the results of the elections in our country recently, I'm convinced that the majority of the public here are not in favor of a war. And I think the American people and the Iraqi people want exactly the same thing, which is peace, families, food, money. And I think it would be a powerful symbol if somehow we could connect with the Iraqi public through a nonviolent peace symbol, if you will.
Kevin, hang on. I want to open up a little exchange between you and Gene Sharp here, because Gene Sharp, if I've read you correctly, I've read a kind of mixed message on this kind of gesture, on chanting for peace and singing for peace and raising symbols of peace. Is that what you're talking about?
No. There are times people are put in situations when the best they think they can do is to say no. And I respect
no war.
No war, no violence. I can respect that, but that's not what I'm talking about. I think peace groups have failed in that they have concentrated on what to say no to and what they will not recommend, what they will not support.
But here's Kevin. He wants to oppose war. He can imagine doing it through raising a symbol of opposition.
That's his problem or his opportunity, depending on how you view it. What is necessary to do is what some of your other callers were asking for. How on earth do you get rid of a dictatorship if you're not going to use war? Because if you don't have another method, another technique that's equally powerful or more effective than military means, then people are going to support the military means.
Kevin, do you feel an option at your fingertips?
I still do, I guess, and I'm surprised that, you feel so strongly against it. I just don't think that the governments are at all getting the message that none of us want this war. And I don't know how I just don't see under the oppression that they're under that how the Iraqi people can start, whatever example you use, start demonstrating in the streets or start having strikes in their workplaces, because I think that they're so fearful of oppression. I think that I would guess, although I don't know, as Gene Sharp said earlier, he's not an expert, I'm not an expert in Iraq, certainly. I would guess that if the Iraqi people can send some simple message that they're just against war and we're doing it at the same time in the same manner, something would start, because something's got to start it, and something's got to start it soon.
Gene, thanks for your call. We've got the point, but I'm reading Gene Sharp's, or Kevin, I'm thinking, I guess. I'm reading Gene Sharp's body language in opposition, wanting more here, wanting something more aggressive than opposition to war, more aggressively focused on a problem. Is there... We've only got half a minute left, but how do you know when the stars are aligned for this kind of nonviolent opposition, aggressive opposition to oppression, to take root, to take off? Or can it happen anytime?
Sometimes it won't happen, but many times it can happen. We can increase the number of cases in which it happens. If we can disseminate the knowledge that there are other ways of undermining dictatorships, if we can focus resources and brains and energies on developing those other ways of undermining dictatorships, then people and governments will have a choice. If you don't do that, military means are all they think they've got.
Gene Sharp, we're out of time. I want to thank you for joining us tonight. It's been great having you.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Gene Sharp is president and founder of the Albert Einstein Institution in Boston. You can join this conversation online at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're funded by...